Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Come on, let's get going now.
From KMOX Sports.
We're primed and ready.
All day, baby.
Man, let's go.
This is the Graybar Sports Open Live. Graybar, your distributor for electrical and datacom needs on 104.1 FM, KMOX.
Sports Open Line on this Thursday evening. Nate Gatter with you in for Matt Pauly. We've got a lot to get to later on in the show. We'll be talking to Kevin Acey of the San Diego Union-Tribune. That'll be just after the 7 o'clock hour about his story on San Diego Padres, former St. Louis Cardinals manager Mike Schilt's retirement and some of the fallout from that. We're going to be talking a lot of St. Louis Billikens in this first hour, including in just moments with Stu Durando, mostly about men's and women's soccer, the latter of which has a monster game tonight in Atlantic 10 play. Plus, Earl Austin Jr. will join us to focus on men's basketball. We'll touch on the NFL as well with Patrick Doherty of NBC Sports. Stu Durando is with us first. He covers SLU for his terrific Stu on SLU Substack website. You can find him on Twitter at Stu Durando or go direct to his site at stuonslu.substack.com. Stu, thanks so much for making some time for us on a busy night.
Yeah, no problem, Nate. Thanks for having me.
The SLU women's soccer team, unsurprisingly, 6 wins from 6 in Atlantic 10 play. They've lost just 2 games and drawn 1 on the course of the entire regular season. Their only 2 losses on the road against Penn State and Iowa, 2 of the better teams in the Big Ten, and a draw, kind of a surprise, 0-0 at home against Illinois State in the final non-conference game of the year. But they have been perfect in the Atlantic 10, survived a few 2-1 scares, including one last Sunday against Duquesne. Tonight, though, they play fellow 6-0 Dayton in a game that very much could decide the Atlantic 10 championship. And, of course, that's a championship that the St. Louis women are very much used to winning.
Yeah, and in recent years, it's come down to them and Dayton. Dayton's kind of been chasing them for several years now, trying to catch them at the top of the standings. And year by year, they seem to get a little closer. They've played the ties the last 2 seasons, so this one figures to be close. It's not only for the top of the conference, but a win and a loss here could go a long way toward at large possibilities for the NCAA tournament. For these teams, SLU has yet to post, kind of a significant win, having lost Iowa and Penn State. So they could use kind of a quote unquote signature win, which this would be, to help their RPI, plus also put them in first place if they can take it.
This game will be getting underway in under an hour. 7 o'clock kickoff here at Herman Stadium in Midtown. Still time to get over there for St. Louis and Dayton women in a critical match at the top of the Atlantic 10 because it's the fourth to last game of the regular season as well. So not going to be a lot of time if there is a winner and a loser as opposed to a draw. Not going to be a lot of time for a potential loser of tonight's game to make that up because they would need help with the other team dropping at least 1 game and just 3 to play in the Atlantic 10. Stu, let's talk about the men who are also enjoying a really nice season. Number 20 in the country nationally. They are unbeaten at home, 7-2-4 overall on the season, and have played some good games against big name opponents. Exhibition draw against Notre Dame, a home win over SMU, a 1-goal loss on the road against Indiana, back to one of the top spots in college soccer this year. What have you seen from the men's team?
Yeah, they've kind of been the opposite schedule-wise of the women, where they've played a really strong schedule and they've got some good results. I think they've played five of the top 30 RPI teams. Like you pointed out, some of those results. So those have really helped their strength of schedule. They've had a lot of trouble scoring goals this year, so they've been locked up in a lot of really low scoring, even for soccer games, scoreless draws and so on and so forth. They don't have anyone who stands out offensively. They've just got a lot of guys across the board who are capable of scoring, and I think they're still waiting to see if they can break out. They haven't scored more than two this year. And, you know, again, this is a game for first place. Winner goes into first and has control. And they play less. They play two fewer games than the women in the conference. So this one takes on extra weight.
Stu Durando is with us talking some SLU men's and women's soccer. Let's transition to Billiken's basketball. You can follow Stu on Twitter, at Stu Durando. You can get him on Substack, stuonslu.substack.com, which I saw is up to number 11 among rising sports Substack. So congratulations, sir.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to watch the analytics. Actually, I was number 9 today. So I cracked the top 10 for the first time.
Even better. So, must be in part because of the traffic bump that you've gotten for reporting that the SLU men's basketball team beat Iowa 99-74 in a secret scrimmage last weekend at Shea Fitz Arena. And, of course, that's first-year head coach Ben McCollum at Iowa coming off his season at Drake, where he had a lot of success with the Bulldogs, won the Missouri Valley, took them to the second round of the NCAA tournament after beating Missouri. You've been very firm that you've got the score exactly right. That is, if they played anywhere close to a normal basketball game, as opposed to teams really rotating a lot, and it seems like they did, that's a pretty significant score for St. Louis, even considering Iowa is in potentially a bit of a transitional year.
Yeah, I mean, from what Josh Church would talk about, it sounds like it was two different halves, very close and a little bit sloppy in the first half, but SLU put things together in the second half, especially in the third quarter, and it started making shots. And he described their defense as having been just consistent throughout the whole game, and that, I think, sounded like it was the highlight. They want to be really disruptive with their pressure this year and, you know, use some full court press, that kind of thing. And it sounds like it was probably pretty effective. I did not see any of it. I haven't seen video or anything along those lines, but it sounds like it was really effective against Iowa. And anytime you beat a Big Ten team, a secret scrimmage, a public scrimmage or whatever the heck it is, it can't hurt. People get a little bit crazy about these secret scrimmages and try and make more of them than there is, but you'd rather be on the right side of a 25-point game than the wrong side.
St. Louis is going to play a ton of home games. In fact, only one true road game in the non-conference, only one true road game up until the turn of the year. And it's not, I'm not going to say it's a poor non-conference schedule, but it's not one that is loaded with big-name opponents. Do you think that was intentional from Josh Schertz, bearing in mind that the Billikens got off to that kind of up-and-down start last year, to try to give this team a little bit more runway early in the year to get themselves settled?
No. I think they would have liked it to have been a little bit stronger. Originally, Iowa, going back to, you know, last season, was on the schedule for a neutral game in Des Moines, and that got scratched. And then they had some problems with the scheduling at the their MTE in Palm Springs this year, where apparently the tournament organizers didn't give them the games that they signed a contract to get, or put them in a pod that they were supposed to be in. That affected a home game. So they would have liked a little bit more difficulty. It definitely is not a great non-conference schedule. It's probably weaker than last season's. You have to wait and see how these other teams do throughout the course of the year. But as it looks right now, you know, they have the opportunity and the need to collect a ton of wins in non-conference.
Stu Durando, we appreciate your time, especially when you've got other things to cover this evening. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You can follow Stu on Twitter, at Stu Durando. You can subscribe to his Substack, stuonslu.substack.com. Talking more Billikens coming up after this, men's basketball, with our own KMOX radio analyst Earl Austin Jr., who you hear on every game with Bob Ramsey. They will be on the call in just a few weeks when the Billikens open up the season at Shea Fitz Arena Monday night, November 3rd, against Southeast Missouri. And you will hear him in minutes here as we continue Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX. Graybar Bar Sports Open Line continues on this Thursday evening. Nate Gatter in for Matt Pauly. We're talking St. Louis Billikens in the early part of this first hour. We'll have NFL and some college football coming up later on. In the second hour, we'll talk Cardinals. We'll visit with Kevin Acey of the San Diego Union-Tribune about his story on Mike Schilt and the end of his time as manager of the San Diego Padres. And we will also discuss, as we did a little bit during Rush Hour Sports with Kevin Wheeler, the interest that obviously Albert Pujols has in managing. He's been interviewing with big league teams reportedly, but also the stated interest that Yadier Molina has in managing or coaching that he mentioned in an Instagram post. We'll continue those conversations, get in a little bit of chat about St. Louis City as well, maybe at the end, because we'll have Jen Cease coming in for City Spotlight right after this from 8 to 9 as they gear up for their final game of the season this weekend. Right now, though, we have Earl Austin Jr., who is the radio analyst right here on KMOX for St. Louis men's basketball alongside Bob Ramsey. Been doing those games together for a long time. Earl, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Nate, for having me. How are you?
I'm good. We just talked to Stu Durando a little bit about the men's basketball situation. We didn't get deep into it, certainly not into the roster, which you and I are going to talk about. But first of all, we did touch on the schedule and how home heavy it is, that it's frankly not as strong as they probably would have preferred. And so I would think, Earl, that that puts a lot of pressure. Well, I guess you could look at it two ways. You could say it puts a lot of pressure on them to be very, very good out of the gate because they're going to need a ton of wins and not very many losses in non-conference if they want to preserve an at-large possibility in the NCAA tournament. The other way you could look at it is the NCAA tournament at-large chances are already low enough that perhaps they just look at the non-conference as a tune-up and ultimately A-10 play is going to decide things.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens and see. I think I look for our conference to be a little bit stronger this year with us, VCU, Dayton, George Mason, GW, and Loyola should all be good. So what can enhance the at-large chances of the A-10 is obviously strong performances in the non-conference. And obviously, we got some opportunities. I think obviously you would like to get the, you know, you play Santa Clara and the Grand Canyon. Those are two teams that defeated us last year. And we have Grand Canyon on the home and home at home. And Santa Clara is in Palm Springs. And then you either have like Utah or Minnesota up in Palm Springs. So those are opportunities that you got to take advantage of. And hopefully you put together a strong non-conference record headed into the conference season. I think if you have a strong conference season, you hopefully it doesn't come down to winning the tournament.
Obviously, everybody's familiar with Robbie Avila in the middle for St. Louis, and he's back on the team. I think Billikens fans got familiar with Kalu Anya and with Dylan Warlick last year as the season goes on. But obviously, there is a lot of turnover on this year's roster. Who are the kind of two or three names that you're most excited to see and how they fit into Josh Schertz's plans?
Sure. Also returning is Kellen Thames from last year, who was really playing well last year until he had to leave the lineup with injuries and everything. And that really hurt us when he got hurt down at Illinois State. So he's back. He's probably our best athlete on the team. But, oh, there's so many of them, but just a couple of them. Amari Akatri as well is back, too. He really closed the year strong. He had 20 points and 10 rebounds in our last game against Arkansas State, a 6'6 sophomore guard from Milwaukee, I think, who's really on the upswing as well. As far as newcomers, out of the portal, we got six kids, but probably Quentin Jones is one guy you could really look at. He's a 6'5", kind of a point guard. Could be a combo guard from Northern Illinois. He kind of could score, but he can also set up teammates, has a nice outside jump shot. Inside to help Robbie, we got Paul Otiono, who played at Kenya Pack last year. He's about 6'9", 240. He's a big physical power forward, but he can block shots. He can shoot it a little bit. Good score. And then one guy, just two other guys up there, Deion Brown, a 6'4 guard from Boston College. He's kind of a junkyard dog. He's going to be one of our leading rebounders. Tough, really can defend. And Brady Dunlap, a 6'7", 6'8 forward out of St. John's, who will be one of our better shooters on a team that has a lot of good outside shooting this year. Brody can really fill it up when he's really going.
We're visiting with Earl Austin Jr., our St. Louis Billikens men's basketball analyst here on KMOX. You mentioned Kellen Thames, and I'm glad you did, because I think when he was at his best a couple of years ago, a lot of people felt like we were looking at a future all A-10 guard and one who maybe could have been ready to be that guy as soon as last year. Obviously, he's had his medical issues. There were real concerns about how much, if at all, he was going to be able to get back on the court. What's the outlook from what you've heard right now on how much he's going to be able to go?
All I can go up what I've seen in practice, and look like he's been going strong. He's been attacking the basket like he does. He's a great athlete. He's going to be one of our better defenders. And, you know, he's a decent outside shooter, but he gives you just that pop, you know. He could play guard multiple positions. And I think he's ready to go. I think what's the thing is, he wouldn't be counted on for heavy minutes because I think one thing we've improved upon this year is the depth of this team. Getting to an 8-man rotation is going to be a challenge because we've got about 10, 11 guys who are capable of being contributors at this level, at the A-10 level, which is a good problem to have. And obviously he's one of those guys as well. So I'm just happy to have him back, and he's looking strong and looking healthy. And hopefully that continues throughout the whole season.
It's a good point you make. In some ways, kind of a perfect storm last year with him having the issues that he did, but also how thin the top of that roster was, that in theory they would have loved to have him play such major minutes. Nice to be able to take a little bit of that off of him. Kind of in contrasting or talking about year two in the context of year one, one of the takeaways I think from year one for Josh Schertz was that this is a very complex system that he runs on the offensive end, and you could tell based on some of the up and down results early in the year that it took time for guys to get settled into that system, get fully comfortable, gel with one another within it. Part of that was maybe that he didn't have the depth he would have loved. Kalen Thames was in and out. You know, it was just a sort of up and down start to the year in a lot of ways. On the one hand, now it's year two. There's been more time for guys to get settled in. On the other hand, in the modern game, as you know as well as anybody, there's so much turnover on everybody's roster from year to year. How confident are you that Josh Schertz's system is going to be one that is teachable enough that the Billikens are going to be able to get off to better starts, even if the roster has that kind of significant turnover year over year, just every year annually?
Yeah, I think the one big thing that kind of was a big adjustment was that Robbie got hurt at the beginning of the year, and he missed a lot of time, and he missed a lot of the preseason practice, and then he got hurt again in our first game in South Dakota when we played Santa Clara. So he missed a good chunk of the non-conference. So we kind of had to mix and match. And when he came back, and then we lost Kellen, and Larry left, and everything. Mm-hmm. I think this year, that's one of the real things. Having a lot of depth, I think, really has helped, and I think he really recruited a bigger team, a lot more depth and a lot more size. And one thing he really likes, obviously, outside shooting. He's a guy that really, us teams really rely on the three-point shot. And I think he recruited a lot of young men who really are fit for that system. One young man I didn't mention earlier was Trey Green, a young man from Xavier, 6-foot guard who kind of reminds people of Isaiah Swope, another outstanding small guard who just graduated last year. He can really shoot it from long distance as well. So, like I said, just like any other team that's bringing in a lot of new faces, obviously we got 4 or 5 new freshmen getting some team chemistry while also trying to find a good rotation. It's going to be a work in progress throughout the non-conference season, and so hopefully by the beginning of the season and conference season, that's when you hope to be really rolling and have things. But this will be a continual work in progress. But one thing he did a nice job is the personnel-wise, it's really strong. So if you have a early season injury here or there, you got people in place who can step in and really keep things rolling without a lot of drop-off. And that kind of hurt last year when we lost guys.
Only 2.5 weeks from the opener, Monday night, November 3rd at Chaffetz Arena against Southeast Missouri. A week from tonight, we'll play an exhibition on the road against Bradley and Peoria, but the regular season will tip off for real in 2.5 weeks. Obviously, this is the time of year everybody wants to be positive, and there are a lot of reasons to be positive. But Earl, if I could trouble you for one, maybe not negative, but one concern. At this point, going into the season, if you had to pick out, this is the thing I'm most worried about or I most want to see them do to assuage my concern, what would that area be?
Healthy. Good Lord, as a Billiken fan, we've seen Javonte Perkins tear his ACL in a – preseason game against Rockhurst. Kind of had a decent 22 season, but it really changed the course of our season. Last year, Robbie Avila gets hurt in the public scrimmage. Then he's in and out of the lineup. Lewis Kellen, and I can go on and on. Fred Satch tears an ACL his senior year. So that's the main thing. You just want to. Then, of course, we've had a couple guys nicked already. Deion dealing with a knee, but I think he's back in. I just want to have a good, healthy season. I think then I think you get a chance to see us be the best version of ourselves. And if that team does that, then there's a lot to be excited about, no question.
Well, Earl, we appreciate your time as always. I'm sure we'll be hearing from you plenty more, and certainly we'll be hearing from you 30-odd times once we get to November 3rd. Thanks a lot.
Hey, that's my pleasure. You take it easy now, Nate.
Earl Austin Jr., our analyst on KMOX for St. Louis Billikens men's basketball, joining us this evening on Gray Bar Sports Open Line. Patrick Doherty will be with us next, NFL writer for NBC Sports, and we'll be getting plenty into the Cardinals and Yadier Molina and Albert Pujols and their managerial aspirations. All of that to come in the second hour as well. Stay with us on 104.1 FM KMOX.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Gray Bar Sports Open Line this evening. Nate Gatter in for Matt Pauly. So glad to have you with us. 104.1 FM, 1120 AM KMOX, or joining us on our streams on YouTube, on Twitter, on anywhere else, StreamYard, wherever you're getting us. We're happy to have you with us. You can participate by sending in your questions. You can also call us, of course, or use the TalkBack feature on the free Odyssey app. We've already talked some St. Louis Billikens with Stu Durando and with Earl Austin Jr. We're going to transition, talk a little bit of NFL with Pat Doherty, who is an NBC sports writer covering the NFL. You can follow him at RotoPat. We appreciate you being with us, sir.
My pleasure to be here. And I tell you what, I have some work to do tonight, but I should maybe stick around, I think, and listen to Kevin Acey dish on Mike Schilt. Very interested in what he's got to say there.
It is some dishing. We Kevin and I did that interview about 2 hours ago now, because he was busy this evening, or I guess it's still kind of afternoon for him out in San Diego. And you can imagine he probably has a lot of commitments right now, because that story has gotten a lot of interest, and understandably so. He said he worked on it for over a year in total, from the beginning to end, and it shows. It's awfully comprehensive. And so, if you can make a little time during those last few minutes before Thursday Night Football this evening, I think it's well worth everybody's time. Let's talk about Thursday Night Football first of all, since that's what will be coming up top of everybody's minds. And let's talk about the Cincinnati Bengals, because they're regional-ish here to St. Louis, about 5 hours or so drive east. And a team that would have had significant aspirations coming into the year. Obviously, losing a quarterback the caliber of Joe Burrow is always dramatic. On top of that, I think Jake Browning, I mean, this would be your area of expertise, but Jake Browning played a bit worse than he has in relief of Burrow in the past. The offensive line has been terrible. Just there hasn't been a lot to like. They did play a little bit better at Lambeau last weekend. Is there a path, do you think, for Cincinnati to relevance when Joe Burrow returns, or is this just going to be a lost season?
Maybe the one path is that the AFC North, we're used to it being one of the fiercest divisions in football, and it's just down this year. You know, the Bengals are really disappointing, 2-4. That's not as disappointing as the Ravens at 1-5. And, you know, the Steelers are winning the division right now, but it's kind of classic Mike Tomlin ball. It's kind of classic late period Aaron Rodgers football, where they're not scoring a ton of points. They're basically trying to get to the end of 60 minutes, kind of the classic, like, play not to lose team. So it's a wide open division, especially by AFC North standards. But the Bengals are one of those teams where they didn't really have any margin for error. You know, last year, every game they played was a 60-minute shootout. They were lucky to get to, I believe, 9-8, and they needed like everything to go right in offense to even get to 9-8. They had not many injuries to their important skill players. Burrow stayed healthy all season, and they kind of needed a similar recipe this year. And so they couldn't have anything go wrong, and then they had the worst thing go wrong. The quarterback gets hurt. The timeline, I think, is just too long. He's not coming back until after Thanksgiving. I think Flacco was brought in to just kind of just improve the vibes. I don't know how else to say it. Like, he's a marginal upgrade over Jake Browning, but I think he can do a better job of playing pitch and catch with Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins. But I think that's really just about kind of almost preventing boredom from the players, from the fans, and that it would take a miracle is a strong word, but it's not the most likely outcome that the Cincinnati Bengals make a run.
Let's talk about the Kansas City Chiefs, the you know, a little bit closer, about what, 4 hours, 3.5 hours drive west of here, and a frequent team played on these airwaves with Campbell Wex being part of the Chiefs radio network. Got off to that rocky start 0-2. They've since stabilized. Had the loss in Jacksonville last Monday night, but responded really well Sunday night with a 13-point win over Detroit. How do you evaluate a Kansas City team that is, on the one hand, probably disappointed to be 3-3, on the other hand, showed Sunday night, if nothing else, that they are still one of the forces in this league?
You know, the Chiefs just kind of a bizarre team in that they're 3-3 after 15-2 last year. And I frankly think it's probably a better overall team than they had last year. But, you know, people who listen to the Chiefs every week know they were kind of running unsustainably hot. And kind of, I don't know what else to call it other than those luck categories. And, of course, the better you are, the more luck you make for yourself. But the Chiefs were not going to continue to win every one-score game in existence. You know, they had won double-digit one-score games in a row, and that just does not happen. And they've had like a little regression to the mean in that department this year, where this, like that Jaguars game or the crazy ending, that's the kind of game the Chiefs would have won last year. Just bad luck that they're on the bad end of that this year. But to me, they look really loaded, like stocked up for a stretch run. You know, they're getting Rashee Rice back. They've been passing better. I think 1-53 is probably a better roster than they had last year. It is a really, really tough division. Like 11-6 is probably a good outcome for the Chiefs this year, but 11-6 could be the 2 or 3 seed in the AFC this year. No one really running away with it, and very disappointing start. I think we'll get a good ending for the Chiefs, and I mean, they're still a Super Bowl favorite even after 3-3. I think Chiefs fans can feel good about their chances down the stretch.
Patrick Doherty, NFL writer for NBC Sports, is with us this evening on Campbell X. You can follow him at RotoPat. You kind of stole my thunder on where I was going next, which is to try to make sense of what's going on at the top of the NFL and pick out favorites. So you're thinking you would still have to consider the Chiefs your favorite to win the Super Bowl. The two best records in the NFL right now belong to Tampa Bay and Indianapolis, both 5-1 in the NFC and AFC respectively. I don't think a lot of folks are picking a Buccaneers-Colts Super Bowl. So with the kind of mess that we have, I guess, among all these teams at 3-3, 4-2 that feel pretty good about themselves, how do you sort it all out and say, okay, the Chiefs, and then who are your other 2, 3, 4, 5 teams who you think are legitimate contenders at this stage?
I mean, the Eagles and the Bills are, of course, still going to be right there, but they almost seem to be in a little bit of like that malaise the Chiefs had the past 2 years. I say malaise. The Chiefs made the Super Bowl both those years. They won one of them, but they were just really grinding out games. You know, teams known for explosive offenses. The Chiefs, you know, the fans got tired of seeing like that station-to-station football. They're trying to open it back up this year, but you see the same thing that's kind of happening to the Bills, where the Bills have another very similar problem to Chiefs had, where the receivers got too expensive. They had to get rid of Stephon Diggs. They kind of tried to moneyball the replacements, and it just hasn't worked out yet with the free agent bargains they tried to find, with the early draft picks they used on Keon Coleman, the tight end Dalton Kincaid, and they just haven't had anyone step into that Stephon Diggs void where they're just a little more of a slog going down the field. It's the same thing with the Eagles. And they're both still fine on defense. The Eagles have kind of come back to the pack a little bit on defense. But the teams have come back to the pack just because we're used to them being able to outscore anybody, or at the very least, like, make more explosive plays than anyone else. They've kind of come back to just where the Chiefs are, where every game is going to be close. It's a 60-minute game, and Yeah, I don't know. It's just a really weird year where the team, like early in the season, the Packers look like they might be a force to be reckoned with, but they've had several disappointing games in a row. The Colts, you know, can you really bet on Daniel Jones? The Bucks do strike me as a legitimate dark horse contender, but they're just ravaged by injury. And yeah, it's still only early October, mid-October now, but this is maybe as late in the year as I've ever gone without seeing a team that to me is a clear favorite, which is kind of why I'm just defaulting back to Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs. Like, when in doubt, pick the Kansas City Chiefs to make the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that feels like we could just clip that sentence from the end, and that could be considered the expert analysis. Because, I mean, where else are you really supposed to go? It has been messy. It has been a little bit chaotic. It's a little hard to sort through of it all. And so maybe defaulting back to the Chiefs is not the worst thing in the world. Patrick Daugherty with us this evening on Sports Open Line. Thanks so much for your time. Enjoy the game tonight.
Always my pleasure to come on KMOX anytime.
Yes, sir. We appreciate you. Patrick Daugherty at RotoPat on social media, NFL writer for NBC Sports. We'll wrap up this hour when we return and look ahead to Cardinals baseball talk happening in the second hour with, as mentioned, with Patrick, Kevin Acey of the San Diego Union-Tribune joining us just after the news at the top of the hour. All of that is coming up and more. Graybar Sports Open Line, the voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
Graybar Sports Open Line continues. Nate Gatter in for Matt Pauley on this Thursday evening. Thank you so much for being with us. Wrapping up the first hour, we will be talking a lot of Cardinals in the second hour. If you haven't heard it, you probably have by now. We've been mentioning it, but we'll visit with Kevin Acey of the San Diego Union-Tribune, who wrote the story about Mike Schilt's departure from San Diego, retiring, his choice. Everybody's been very adamant about that, including on the Padres side. But sort of some of the reaction, I suppose you'd say, some insight into how his tenure went and his dealings with his coaching staffs, the support staff, kind of how he handled the front office, all of that. And certainly there are parallels, there are mentions of his time in St. Louis and how a lot of this stuff was comparable. We'll discuss that with Kevin, and then we'll talk just us after the fact as the second hour goes on about that. We'll also discuss Yadier Molina and Albert Pujols and their interest in managing in the major leagues, in Yadi's case, potentially coaching as well, until those managerial opportunities pop up. With Albert, it sounds like the managerial opportunities are going to be popping up without any need to serve as a bench coach or something similar before that. Before we do that, though, we should talk a little bit of college football, because the Missouri Tigers are coming off, in some ways, a very disappointing loss. Not the typical kind of disappointing loss. I feel like in a lot of big games, we've been saying that they just weren't quite there, right? That they weren't at the level that they need to be to compete with the elite teams. And I think it's fair, with the way they've recovered since Florida State in Week 1, to call Alabama one of the elite teams. Maybe you call them one of the 1B tier teams at this stage. Maybe you say that Ohio State, Miami, and Indiana have kind of separated themselves right now as being the top three over Alabama or anybody else. And I could buy that. I wouldn't be upset about that. But even then, you're talking about somebody that's in the 1B tier teams. Certainly one of the top teams, one of the top 10 teams in the country, without a doubt. Maybe one of the top 5 teams in the country. They've settled themselves. And Missouri played well in the game. They weren't perfect. There were still... What's frustrating is some of the repetition. You know, the Zion Young penalty in the first quarter. Just very undisciplined to take a personal foul after the play. That's something Missouri has done far too often in big games. Played like they were not as prepared, like they hadn't been there before, like Alabama had been there before and Missouri hadn't. And I did feel some of that early in the game. But ultimately, Missouri acquitted themselves quite well. They showed that on talent, they could hang around. They showed that on execution, for the most part, they could hang around. It wasn't flawless, but it rarely is in a college football game. And but for Alabama making some big plays down the stretch, you know, turning a 3rd and 25 into a first down, including on a 4th and 8, converting on a 4th down and goal on that last, or I guess it was 2nd to last offensive possession for Alabama with the running out the clock possession at the end. Missouri could have easily gotten a stop on that drive, probably should have gotten a stop on that drive, and we might be talking about something very different. Bo Prabula could have easily picked a different receiver on the interception that effectively ended the game. You know, Marquise Johnson jumping up and down was open. That play was makeable. The frustration, I think, for Missouri is when those moments feel too similar to how past games have gone down. Overall, though, I felt like this was a real step forward, even if it feels like a missed opportunity for Missouri falling to 5-1 in a game they could have won that would have been massive to win. They'll have Auburn on the road, an Auburn program that is in kind of disarray right now with Hugh Freeze dismissing a team captain and a lot of folks, including players, questioning whether he was being totally truthful in the explanation that he gave. That line has moved a lot, maybe because of that. Auburn was favored coming into the week, and that is no longer the case. Missouri is going to be dealing with a difficult environment. It's a night game in what's become one of the more underrated stadiums in the SEC because Auburn hasn't been very good. That's going to be a big challenge. If they bounce back and win that game, everything is still on the table, even with tough games coming up. We'll talk a little bit more about Missouri maybe in the second hour as well, where we have time. But it's Cardinals discussion next here on KMOX.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
Hour two of Graybar Sports Open Line this evening. Nate Gatterbeck with you in for Matt Pauley. And as promised, we're going to be talking Cardinals in this second hour, starting with discussion of former Cardinals and now former Padres manager Mike Schilt, who retired at the end of the Padres season when they fell in the wild card series to the Chicago Cubs. And more interestingly, a story this week that I don't know if you call it a bombshell, maybe that sensationalizes things, but certainly I think it's reverberated around San Diego and St. Louis on some of the frictions that existed for Mike Schilt and his 2 years in San Diego, and that contributed to his surprising exit as well a few years ago as Cardinals manager in St. Louis. That story came from Kevin Acey in the San Diego Union Tribune, and Kevin is kind enough to join us this evening on Sports Open Line. Kevin, how you doing?
I'm fantastic, yeah.
Been a busy week for you, busy couple of days since the story came out. Let's start with what a lot of folks are probably wondering around St. Louis, which is how is it that in a matter of days after the Padres season and Mike Schilt's retirement came down, you have this incredibly insightful, well-sourced piece, including half a dozen current and former Cardinals sources who are referenced in it. Meanwhile, for years in St. Louis, all we got was kind of the company line of philosophical differences.
Yeah, I can't speak to that. I'm going to say that this is a story I worked on for, you could say, for more than a year. I mean, when hints first started that, you know, Mike was, you know, maybe not the same all the time, right? And then for sure, most of this season, I was asking around and talking with people and, you know, what I would call reporting the story and, you know, deciding what were the merits of this story? How legitimate was it? Okay, it's legitimate. What are the merits here? Do people, you know, how are people feeling about it affecting their job, affecting the team? The team continues to win. Coaches are saying, you know, I'm just focused on now, but they've described certain behaviors. And, you know, the time became when Mike retired and there were questions about, and there still might be questions about how it all went down, you know, A, B, C, D, E, and all the steps. But I felt like that was the time and that was the real story. And it was important to talk to Mike about it. And I did that. Why it didn't happen in St. Louis. Look, I've had stories where later, someplace, some other time, people talk for whatever reasons. But I can't speak to why it came out there. I will say that as I was, reporting this over the past 6 months, I was looking and seeing if there had been anything and asking around. And I guess I was a little surprised. But again, I've been there.
Well, Kevin, we appreciate the level of depth of the reporting here. As you said, I mean, it reads like a story that you poured over a year into, you know, it, steadily getting that reporting to where it needed to be to put together something as comprehensive as this. To go back to kind of the Cardinals tie-in, you do mention some of the quotes that Schilt had at the beginning of his time as an advisor with the Padres, spring training 2022, mm-hmm. which was just a few months after he had been fired by the Cardinals, and he was characterizing it as potentially caring too much in the way that he was trying to hold various folks accountable, including maybe people in departments that he didn't really run and didn't have autonomy over. And he was talking about the fine line and how he intended to not push as hard if he got another opportunity to manage, which, of course, came a couple of years later with the Padres. Do you think, based on the reporting you've done and kind of comparing and contrasting his exits in San Diego and St. Louis, that the Padres' Mike Schilt was, in the end, largely the same as Cardinals' Mike Schilt? Or do you think there were changes that he made?
I can't speak to whether there were no changes he made, but the answer to the first part of the question is that he was largely the same Mike Schilt. And that's what stands out to you. And Mike even remarked, and believe me, Mike and I went over what parts, you know, painstakingly almost, what parts of the conversation were on the record and off the record. And Mike said on the record that, yes, it was eerily similar, you know, the things that he was hearing or that were being said. And what does stand out to me, has stood out to me over the course of all of this, Mike does not believe Mike did anything wrong. He did not. I thought it was crucial to the story that Mike didn't refute the substance of what was being said. Mike refuted that there was anything more than him caring too much and having a high standard, and in some cases a higher standard than others were able to live up to. And, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but I mean, there's just a lot there. And Mike's a perfectionist, and Mike's a very good manager. And Mike, you know, I happen to believe, look, Mike and I had our things there. Yeah, we did. If this were personal, this story would have been written a long time ago. But I like Mike, and there's just a lot there. And I think that a lot of people, look, a lot of people don't like him for what would appear to be their own good reasons. But there's a lot of people very conflicted who do like Mike Schilt.
That's kind of sets up something that I was thinking about when I was reading the piece. And I want to be clear, this is my sort of impression, something I'm taking away from it, not something that's written specifically in it. But it made me think of the movie Whiplash, which is kind of all about a teacher. And to be fair, in that instance, a young man that he's teaching, not a professional baseball player or a professional baseball coach. And it's all about how far is too far in the pursuit of greatness. And kind of to your point, which is Schilt saying, sure, I did a lot of this stuff, but I think that was fair, and I think that's within the realm of the job as a major league manager. And even some of the staff members, one coach who you mentioned who, quote, did not appreciate how Schilt treated him, acknowledged he had become a better coach in large part due to Schilt's demands and feedback. That feels to me like everybody agrees on what happened. It's just a question of whether that was too far. Do you think that's a fair way of putting it, that Mike Schilt's vision of how far is too far is just different than what some of the assistants and his support staff thought?
Yes, I think that's fair. And I think that it, you know, I also think there's more to it in that, like, you know, what is one person's too far and another person's? And yeah, I do. And I think we should make clear, too, that none of this is coming from players. Mike took great pains to take care of his players. And Mike did care about his coaches and his players and their careers, and in particular, the players. And so I want to make sure that that's clear, that these are clashes people, and, you know, he talks about not having autonomy for, and there being some frustration there, both St. Louis and San Diego, where the manager doesn't have full control over the training staff, the and other departments. That, but then he also is sort of accountable for those departments to a certain extent. And so Mike's whole aim is excellence. And for him, man, the guy lived the Cardinal way, right? Like, he just lived it. You guys all heard it. We in San Diego heard it for years. He just carried that burden. And other parts of the story talk about that, about Mike Schilt being out and hearing, someone say something like, you know, hey, good job, can't wait for the World Series parade. And the way Mike Schilt hears that is, oh my gosh, these people want me to win the World Series. And, you know, Mike Schilt has a high standard for himself and others.
We're visiting with Kevin Acey of the San Diego Union Tribune. You can follow him on Twitter or X as at SDUT, Kevin Acey. That's A-C-E-E. SDUT, Kevin Acey, talking about his story on Mike Schilt and the departure in San Diego that you were very clear was on his own terms, that the Padres were, by all accounts, happy to have him back for another year. Do you think... And this, again, this is something where maybe different people would have their own individual answers. But from an organizational standpoint, whether that's ownership, whether it's A.J. Preller and baseball operations, whoever kind of represents the organization in that sense, the Padres feel that the 2 years of Mike Schilt was worthwhile, I suppose, or was it was the right decision to bring him in, even bearing in mind now that there was some acrimony over those 2 years?
Yeah, 183 wins in the 2 years. You go back to 2024, and I know that, you know, if you didn't kind of live it or you weren't watching it, that it's like that it's ifs and buts, right? Don't really matter. But, like, the Padres were up, had two games to win once and eliminate the Dodgers in the National League Division Series, and they did not score in either of those games. And the Dodgers have spoken since then about believing that that's when they won the World Series, when they got past the Padres. The Padres were an excellent team. Mike changed a mindset in a lot of ways. He changed the leadership structure in the clubhouse. He got guys to buy into a certain way of playing and a what Mike was very proud of, a togetherness. I don't think that really anybody would dispute that. I mean, at one point I referenced in the story that no one questions that the Padres are better off having had Mike Schilt there. And the plan was to bring him back. Now, I will say, I don't think there's a lot of tears among those who had to deal with him on a daily basis that he's gone. But no, and that's the complex nature. Isn't that crazy? The complex nature of Mike Schilt's tenure and his legacy is that no one's really shedding any tears, but they're saying, yeah, we're better for having him.
To that point, you know, last one for you, Kevin Acey of the San Diego Union Tribune is with us here on Gray Bar Sports Open Line. You've mentioned it already that this was a totally different scenario with the players, right? The way Mike Schilt managed the players as people was totally different than how he managed the coaching staff, the support staff, even to some extent how he treated the people who were maybe not under him, the front office folks, A.J. Preller. Just the way those relationships were was very different on the field versus off. What do you think it says about Mike Schilt? What do you think his priorities were in treating the players who are professionals in their own right, much higher paid than his coaching staff, most of them, in treating the players so differently than his coaching staff and the other support personnel?
I don't know other than that he was above them. Like, I don't know. And of course, I guess, you know, ostensibly he's above the players, but I think we know in today's modern game where the players stand, and especially some of them, right? You mentioned the money, and, you know, the fact is the more money you make, the less likely it is you're going to be gotten rid of. And there, what, were 10, 15 players on the Padres who made more than Mike Schilt? So I'm just kind of going down your train of thought, and it's an interesting one, man. It really is. It's like, how could that be? And plenty of people talked about how in one part of the clubhouse he would be a certain way, and at times, not all the time, by the way, people enjoyed being around him sometimes. It's not like there's a madman running around. I think anybody who's seen Mike Schilt on camera knows what he's like a lot of the time. Now, of course, if you've seen him on camera, you know what he's like. His press conferences got increasingly testy for absolutely no reason other than that Mike thought that, you know, it was unreasonable to question him. It was very interesting. But I can't answer that other than to say that Mike felt it was the, and I heard this for a long time, almost since he was an advisor and I got to know him fairly well. Mike felt it was his job and the coach's job to make the players better, to further their careers, to get the team to a championship. That's what he felt like the job that he could control was, him and his coaches helping the players. They worked for the players. That's Mike Schilt's philosophy, and that might be as simple as it is.
To that end, I lied. One more quick one. When you say, you know, it's all about making the players better, for anybody who wasn't able to get to read the story, and you should go to the San Diego Union Tribune and read the story, because it is comprehensive, as I said. But it, for folks who haven't been able to read it, the takeaway was that Mike Schilt is relieved to be walking away from management, doesn't plan to return to it, but that he is open to, if not looking forward to, the possibility down the line of returning to baseball in some kind of player development capacity.
Yes. And I don't think anyone really would question. I don't know the people in the Cardinals. As a matter of fact, I know there's at least some people I've talked to wouldn't question that he's darn good at that job. And that there were some things that changed when he became a manager. But that he is really good at coaching baseball. Yeah, that is what he seems adamant about. I can't stress that enough. It's not like he's just saying it. Now, he may be. Maybe he does want to manage again. I'm not inside another person's head. But I'm telling you, he is vehemently against managing again. But that's, of course, we've all been there, right? He's in the moment right now, and he does not want to manage again.
Well, Kevin, we so appreciate your time and all the work that you poured into this piece. It really shows. Thank you so much for visiting with us tonight on KMOX.
Right on. Take care.
Kevin Acey of the San Diego Union-Tribune. You can follow him at SDUT, Kevin Acey. That's K-E-V-I-N-A-C-E-E. SDUT, Kevin Acey, joining us to discuss his piece on Mike Schilt's retirement from managing from the San Diego Padres and potentially from baseball, but might still be a return in another capacity. We'll talk more about that. More Cardinals and potential former Cardinals becoming managers later on in this hour. Albert Pujols and Yadier Molina both expressing interest in that as well. That's still to come. Graybar Sports Open Line continues on KMOX after this. I appreciate Kevin Acey having come on with us. If you missed the interview, you can go back and hear it on the free Odyssey app, AUDACY. We'd love to get your thoughts on it. You can comment on our streams, on Twitter, on Facebook. You can call in as well. As always, you can hit us on the talkback feature on that free Odyssey app. That listener line, by the way, if you forgot, 314-436-7900. You can call in and give us your thoughts. I imagine a lot of people have been thinking over this Mike Schilt story from Kevin Acey over the last couple of days since it came out and have been talking about it. Certainly, we've been talking about it on this these airwaves. And I don't want to belabor that discussion more than necessary. I felt like the opportunity to have the author of the story on was worthwhile. I do want to touch on one other angle that I feel confident we haven't talked about or we haven't talked about enough. And I kind of hinted at it with the first question that I asked Kevin. And understandably, he really is not in a position to go there. It's not his area of expertise, and he probably wouldn't want to even if he knew. Why did we not get this story years ago? How come San Diego gets this story after days, and St. Louis has to get San Diego's sloppy seconds years later? Because one of the themes of the story, which, by the way, if you weren't listening to the interview, includes at least six current and former Cardinal sources. So there were Cardinals folks, at least now, who are willing to talk. Maybe they weren't at the time. Maybe everybody tried and nobody would talk even off the record. Maybe. I doubt that. But it's possible. There are Cardinals people in this story. There are references of directly addressing what happened in St. Louis. I'm not saying that it's a major focal point. Obviously, San Diego is the major focal point of the story, as it should be, because Kevin has more San Diego sources. He was there on the ground all the way through the 2 years of Schilt. He's writing for a San Diego audience primarily, though I'm sure he knew this story was going to get national traction, and it has very much so. He's been a man in demand. All the more reason we appreciate him making the time for us. He probably knew that after San Diego, St. Louis was going to be the market second most interested. What I want to talk about is why we didn't have this story here. And I hesitate to attribute it to the fact that all of a sudden a bunch of sources who were unwilling to speak for years were willing to speak to Kevin Acey in San Diego. More likely, as I have complained about in one way or another, we have a media environment that is not cutthroat, which is okay. I'm not saying I want to live in a New York media environment, which seems not only toxic, but exhausting. But one that is just too soft. a lot of the time, and one that I think isn't always working for the consumer in the way that it should be. The responsibility of media is to the consumers of that media, not to anyone else. Certainly not to protect the St. Louis Cardinals or to protect Mike Schilt or whomever else. And I don't know that Mike Schilt comes out of this story as the total bad guy either. I want to be clear. You know, I think that's one of the reasons that I referenced the movie Whiplash when talking to Kevin Acey, is because I think this, like a lot of scenarios like it, like a lot of great stories of coach and player, of tutor and pupil, of development of people at the direction of another, there's going to be disagreement in society about how heavy is too heavy a hand, right? Think about how many different approaches American parents have with American children on how hard should they be working them in school. You know, how many math problems should you be drilling your seven-year-old on? How soon is too soon to have your kid grinding away in the weight room at 6 a.m.? Right? There, some of this is maybe going to be objective fact. Maybe some of this you could go to the doctors and other experts in psychology or physiology or development, and you could get objective answers. Some of it is going to be subjective. And especially that's true at the very top levels. These are professional athletes, professional baseball coaches, because really we're talking about the coaches and the support staff personnel more than we are the players, because there's no indication. In fact, Kevin is quite adamant in the story and in the interview that none of this is about the players, right? Mike Schilt was, if anything, that's something that I imagine could wear on the coaching staff, is that he's a different guy with them than he is with the players. Mike Schilt's very protective of that relationship with the players and had a very good one. So it's more about professional baseball coaches, but these are people operating at the very top level of their sport in the country and the world. So it's reasonable to say you got to go pretty far before it's too far. A manager, a person in a position of authority at that level can be relatively heavy-handed before it's too far. I don't think it's unreasonable to say that. So none of this is necessarily an attack on Mike Schilt. I think different people are going to draw different conclusions from this. And Mike Schilt, I think, feels that way. He understands that this is not a story that everyone's going to react well to. In fact, plenty of people might react badly to it. But he's not refuting it. I don't know that he's apologizing for it, for that matter. He's saying, I have my methods, right? It's kind of the Michael Jordan documentary, right? There's the moment where he asks them to cut and take a break in the interview because they're talking about how extreme he was, especially in practices. And he says, if you don't want to play that way, don't play that way. Right? And you could tell he's taking it a little bit personally, feeling like he's getting attacked for his method and saying, well, I won a lot of games, won a lot of championships. My method's got something to it. If you can't take it, that's not really my problem. That shows that you're not as committed as I am to being great. And that's a defensible position. So I just want to be clear that this is not an attack on Mike Schilt. I'm not saying why wasn't there a hit piece on Mike Schilt, because I don't think this is one. Right? I think this is just an assessment. It's a behind the scenes, and it explains why a successful tenure in San Diego lasted only 2 years, a successful tenure in terms of wins and losses, relative to the team that he took over as well, one that was pretty dysfunctional and that had a very unsuccessful 2023. Same thing has kind of happened in St. Louis, where he had three successful seasons and the Cardinals made the playoffs in the subsequent year and then not since. So you have a guy who's having a lot of success on the field, there's no question, both in St. Louis and San Diego, and both tenures have been short. Both have ended abruptly and surprisingly. The one in St. Louis ended very much not on his terms. But again, the piece I wanted to talk about is the media side of this, because I think in a media market the size of St. Louis, which again, San Diego is not some massive market compared to St. Louis. It's not one with tremendously greater media resources. It's not one with a tremendously tougher readership or tougher media. You know, you're not talking about New York or Boston or Philadelphia. We're not talking about Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco. We're not even talking about Seattle or Dallas. We're talking about cities that are maybe not comparable culturally, right? But comparable in the sense of media markets and resources and what kind of coverage they're used to, how adversarial that coverage is or isn't. What grinds my gears is the fact that we had to wait so long for such a tremendously impactful story. Right, this philosophical differences company line we got from the Cardinals dominated conversations for a while and is still a reference point now. It's become a touchstone in Cardinals conversations ever since. And we didn't get this story, which must have been out there. And then what you'll get from people in the know in St. Louis media is like, well, yeah, I knew this. You know, everybody who's in the know knew this already, that people were frustrated with Mike Schilt, that there were people who thought he was difficult to work for, that there were people who thought he went too far, that there were, according to Kevin Acey's story, Cardinals staff members who were going to quit, who were threatening to quit their jobs if Mike Schilt was not fired. And people in the local media will act like, oh, yeah, that was known. Well, why didn't you report it then? Because I'm going to tell you this. As a reporter, and that's a little different. I should probably paint with a slightly narrower, more specific brush. Because we're really talking about reporters, journalists here. Because media is kind of a catch-all term. And this doesn't apply to talking heads, like, I suppose, for these purposes, myself. Or to random commentators on social media. This applies to serious reporters. The nature of the job, the purpose of the job, why you get paid, is not for what you know. It's like being a coach in that way, right? It's not what you know, it's what the players know. Same thing if you're a reporter. It's not what you know, it's what your readers know. It's what your viewers know. It's what your listeners know. That's what counts. And I don't know what the incentive is to not tell this story. If nobody had this story, how is that possible? How is a guy in San Diego, years after the fact, scooping the entire St. Louis media? If people did have the story, how was it not told? And why? I don't know in this instance. I have some hypotheses. I don't know why that would be, except that we, as a city, and by we here, I mean not so much the media, I mean the consumers of media, need to demand more of that. We need to ask for and consume a little more toughness. Nothing extreme, nothing unnecessarily combative, but we need to want and to show we want a little bit more in holding teams accountable. Talked about this a lot in St. Louis City coverage, and I'll probably talk about it a little bit as we wrap up this hour, heading toward the city spotlight with Jen Cease in the next hour. This is not so much Jen's bailiwick, but it is mine, to talk about the fact that I think St. Louis City are run, I don't want to say ineptly, but are run poorly by people who don't really have a plan. I think this year that's been more obvious than ever, and we don't hold them sufficiently accountable. Certainly not until it's too late. We force you to string together multiple bottom of the Western Conference seasons before we really start to demand something in terms of accountability. And I think that's some of what played out here. So I hope we demand more, because it is totally unacceptable for us to be getting this story years removed and secondhand from San Diego about, hey, a fundamental event, a very significant event, one of the most significant events in the last half decade of Cardinals baseball. You're getting the real story now, finally, from somebody half a country away, years after the fact. It's a hugely important event, provides a lot of context. The one other thing I'll say, and I think people have already mentioned this, it, to me, makes John Mozeliak look really good, because he never said this publicly, and he never leaked it. Or if he did, he couldn't find somebody willing to write it, and I think he could have found somebody willing to write it if he wanted to. This story was never out there, and that says that John Mozeliak was willing to wear this one. And I don't know if that's doing a solid to Mike Schilt. I don't know if it's just what he thought of as the way the Cardinals do their business. Either way, I do think it changes things a little bit, because I think folks put that Mike Schilt firing on John Mozeliak, and it sounds like he might have made the right decision. At the very least, he might not have had much of a decision to make, because he might have been poised to lose a ton of people out of his organization, at least a few, is what we would understand if he had kept Mike Schilt. And it sounds like that environment might have been one where it was not the right decision for him or for any other president of baseball operations to retain Mike Schilt for reasons that weren't readily apparent on the field. Again, folks are going to draw different conclusions from this. Different people are going to have different levels of tolerance for how far is too far. And we don't get specifics, right? Because in these situations, in order to get information that he needs to tell the story, somebody like Kevin Acey or any other good reporter, they can't give you all the details because they have to protect certain people. because that's how you get the information in the first place. That's how you make it solid enough to run the story. There has to be some vagary left in there around the edges. You can only get so particular. And so we're not going to be able to draw specific conclusions. We're not going to get a video of Mike Schilt doing XYZ to an assistant coach or to a support staff member or saying XYZ in a conversation with AJ Preller, who runs baseball operations for the Padres. We're not going to get those kind of specifics. We're in a world where we're used to all getting to see firsthand what happened, hear firsthand what happened to make our own opinion. That's not going to happen here, which in some ways means that the breadth of opinions is going to be even wider because people are going to be filling in some gaps with their own assumptions. I'm not really interested in doing that. I'm not drawing any strong conclusion about Mike Schilt one way or the other off of this, and I think it's been talked around for a couple of days now in St. Louis, and we've probably talked it out at this point. But the media, the reporting angle on it is one that I wanted to touch on because I think it's very, very frustrating as someone who cares about and has been engrossed in, for better or worse, the narratives that have been around this team and have been present in this fan base in the Cardinals conversations that we've had in recent years. This is a piece of the story that would have been really nice to know at the time. Could have saved us a lot of trouble in the last couple of years. We could have had this debate back then and we could have been past it, because we would have understood where things came from instead of speculating about what this meant for John Mozeliak, what it meant for ownership, all of that. Because as it turns out, the decision to fire Mike Schilt, I think, had nothing to do with the stuff that we all thought it did. Right? I don't think anybody was speculating that this was why they fired Mike Schilt. So that's all there is really to say about that. But you can feel free to chime in if you want. I think a lot of people probably feel like we're talked out on this, and that is fair enough. We're going to wrap this up. We're going to talk a little bit about Yadier Molina and Albert Pujols and their managerial aspirations next. And then we will finish up with a little bit of St. Louis City and talk to our friend Jen Cease before she takes over for a City Spotlight from 8 to 9 this evening. Graybar Sports Open Line continues on KMOX. Wrapping up our final hour of Graybar Sports Open Line here on KMOX. Nate Gatter back with you. Kyle Sixta running things in our studio. Jen Cease will be with us for our final segment in moments before she takes over for City Spotlight this evening from 8 to 9, getting you set for the final game of the season for St. Louis City. We'll talk about that in just a moment. First, let's finish up Cardinals chat and Cardinals adjacent chat with talking about Albert Pujols and Yadier Molina as managerial candidates. Albert Pujols reportedly has interviewed for at least a couple of jobs. He could be a candidate for the Padres job, but certainly he's been linked to the Angels and potentially to the Orioles as well. So there's some interest. I think it's safe to say that if Albert wants a managerial job in the major leagues badly, he'll probably have one this year. I would think worst case for him is he's managing the Angels. And Yadier Molina then posted on Instagram expressing his interest in coming back to Major League Baseball as a manager, as a coach. These kind of things get people very stirred up in St. Louis because, for better or worse, mostly for better, St. Louis is a loyal place in the way that provincial Midwestern cities tend to be. The downside of this is I'm not sure what evidence we're relying on that Albert Pujols or Yadier Molina would be especially good managers. There's not a lot of evidence to say they wouldn't be, but I personally don't think that hitting 700 home runs indicates you'd be a better manager than the next guy. I don't know that it's necessary to command respect in clubhouses. I think sounds like Mike Schilt commanded plenty of respect in clubhouses. I think Ollie Marmol commands plenty of respect in clubhouses. I think Sean McVay commands plenty of respect in the Los Angeles Rams locker room. I don't think it's necessary to have played at the top level, certainly not to have been a great player at the top level, in order to get that kind of treatment from players, get that respect. The other thing, you know, Albert Pujols' managerial opportunity seems like it's going to happen somewhere. I think people have kind of accepted that, and it's not going to be here this year. And so hopefully that could, you know, if he takes that job with the Angels or the Orioles or the Padres, wherever, people can kind of just let that go and not have a fit about it. The bigger thing will be if Yadier Molina goes somewhere else, especially if he follows Albert somewhere for an assistant position, bench coach, whatever. The other concern that I have about Yadier Molina, and I guess it applies to both of them, but I think with Yadier Molina it's more obvious, is that I wonder if, and this is not terribly uncommon for guys who are a couple of years removed from playing, if the desire to be back in the game, to be associated with it, to feel like they're part of it still, is stronger than the desire to actually do the job. Because being a manager, being a coach in Major League Baseball is not just being on the team, right? It's not that being a player is easy either, but it's not just going to be, I get to go to the ballpark again, I get to wear the uniform again, I get to have something, you know, other than being retired going on in my life. I get to feel like I'm a major leaguer again. It's so much more than that. And a lot of it would be things that those guys probably won't like to do. With Kevin Wheeler earlier, we talked about, with Yadier Molina in particular, how would that go with all the media responsibilities? Would he enjoy doing that? We've kind of let it go. We kind of let it go at the time. Yadier Molina, at least for a short period of time, decided he didn't really want to be a player his last year, and he'd rather go off to Puerto Rico and take a little vacation to be an owner of a minor league basketball team. And that was going to be his focus for a few days. In the middle of the season, he was playing. The Cardinals paid him several hundreds of thousands of dollars just for the couple of days that he didn't show up to work. What makes us think, then, that he's going to be ultra-dedicated to doing all the details of being an assistant coach? What makes us think that Yadier Molina won't get into the dog days of July and August and say, I have so much money. I absolutely don't need to do this job. How many guys do you know who are multimillionaires, who are worth tens or hundreds of millions, who regularly take orders from other people and just do what other people tell them to do? And when other people say, you've got to show up early and stay late on this Tuesday to do things that I don't want to do, how many of them just say, sir, yes, sir? I'm not saying, I don't know him, right? I'm not accusing anybody of anything. I just think Cardinals fans, and this is probably true of any team anywhere, they hear Yadier Molina, they hear Albert Pujols, and they associate them with all the great feelings that they had when they were players. Those things have, to me, almost nothing to do with evaluating them as coaching or managerial candidates. They have to be able to stand on their own in that regard. And I'm just not seeing what is the evidence. Now, it's got to start somewhere, right? It's kind of a catch-22 of saying, well, he has no experience, he has no coaching or managerial resume. No, he doesn't until he does, right? Somebody's got to be the first one to hire him. It's not going to happen. If Yadier Molina said, I'll go through an entire year as the Memphis Redbirds bench coach, that would go a long way for me, right? If he can ride the bus, fly commercial for a whole year, okay, then I'll believe it. I wouldn't be moving mountains. Certainly, I wouldn't be indicating clearing the path for him right away, because all that's indicating is the same kind of special treatment that I don't think, if he's going to come in, it's going to be a manager, to be a bench coach, to be whatever his role is, not to be Yadier Molina, the bench coach. He's going to be the bench coach. That's it. And he's going to use his skills. He's going to be himself. But it can't be to get some kind of special treatment or to have some kind of different standard or to be treated differently than anybody else. Because being Yadier Molina in and of itself, being Albert Pujols in and of itself, is not going to win games. Not the way it did when they were on the field, certainly. All right, quick timeout, and then we'll have Jen Cease get you set for City Spotlight coming up in the next hour. Back in a moment on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
Nate Gatter filling in for Matt Pauley on this Thursday evening. Wrapping up Graybar Sports Open Line, but more sports coverage is coming up on KMOX this evening. Jen Cease will have City Spotlight coming up after the news until 9 o'clock. Jen, so good to have you in the studio. It's been too long.
The last time we got to do this, we had much more time than we have tonight.
Yeah, we have almost no time. So I will give the mic to you, which is what people want to hear anyway. What's going on from 8 to 9?
I say, I've already got an hour of soccer. I don't know if people want more than that on Sports Open Line, but we are going to cover, I want to spend a lot of time in that first segment hearing from David Critchley. I think Critch has made a really good case for him to be considered as a head coach. So we're going to hear some clips from him from earlier this week. Dale Schilley will come along to do some analysis. We'll hear Marcel Hartl's player profile. Great stuff there. And then we'll wrap it up with play-by-play voice Joey Zanaboni.
So I am not going to get too deep down the road right now because we just don't have time of the situation City have put themselves in by hiring Olaf Melberg, who apparently just lied to them in the interview, then firing him very quickly, which they kind of had to do, and then waiting a while and firing Lutz Fanensteel months later. But at minimum, I would have to think it's put David Critchley kind of in the driver's seat to get this job, because they've played better, right? They've won three of their last four. Things are not bad right now, certainly not as bad as they've been. And they kind of have a lot in flux. It wouldn't be the worst thing to have a little continuity.
A little continuity. And the players are also speaking about it. You'll hear in Hartl's interview that he simply says, we're playing for the coach, and he thinks the coach should keep the job.
And, you know, and you'd think that people are paying attention to that. Right. That moves the needle at a certain
point. He's going to be back, and Marcel's considered a leader. So, I mean, granted, the players don't get to make the choices, but I would think some level of continuity somewhere for City can't hurt.
You would think. At this point, what could hurt after the last couple of years? Might as well try something. Jen Cease will have City Spotlight coming up after the news. We are looking forward to hearing all of that. That'll do it for us this evening on Graybar Sports Open Line. We so appreciate all of our guests. Kevin Acey of the San Diego Union Tribune with the Mike Schilt story. Patrick Doherty of NFL on NBC. Earl Austin Jr., our KMOX St. Louis men's basketball analyst. And Stu Durando, who covers the Billikens for his Stu on Slew Substack. All of them, my producer Kyle Sixta, Nate Gatter saying so long this evening. City Spotlight coming up on the other side on KMOX.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.